This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Sunkalp Arora and his fellow graduate students at Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute knew how to use autonomous drones to acquire data reliably and efficiently from physical spaces. What they couldn't figure out was which physical spaces to apply their technology to. Through classes, fellowships, connections, and 175 customer discovery calls, they finally found the perfect problem to solve, a continuous need for visibility in warehouses. Now, Pittsburgh-based Gather AI, the company they founded in 2018, provides software-based automated inventory monitoring for warehouses. It has 27 employees and has raised a total of $17 million. Sunkalp, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thanks for the kind introduction.
Tell us, just to start, what does Gather AI do for its customers?
We provide real-time inventory monitoring for warehouses and fulfillment centers using a fleet of autonomous drones.
Autonomous meaning they fly without anybody controlling them?
Oh, yes, they fly by themselves. All you have to do is select the locations to scan, press takeoff. They will collect images of the locations that needed to be scanned, convert that into inventory data, and all of that data is visible on your web dashboard for anyone through your organization to see if they want to.
Wow. And how might a warehouse do that if they didn't have your autonomous drones?
So typically, warehouses have dedicated inventory controllers and inventory controlling teams who would go out with barcode readers or with notepads in some cases and see if the inventory is matching what the warehouse management system says. And if it doesn't match, they correct the warehouse management system. No warehouses, Kathleen, they are vertical in nature. Sometimes they go 40, 50 feet high. So there were cases where either someone would have to bring the pallet down to take that inventory and bake it and put it back up. Or in other cases, a person would climb a scissor lift or a forklift and go up there that high to take inventory. So that manual process ends up being really slow.
You have two co-founders, Daniel Maturana and Gitesh Dubey. Did I say those correctly?
Yes, Daniel and Gitesh.
Yes. So all three of you earned degrees that lined you up for high-paying corporate jobs. You've also been approached by large companies interested in licensing your software. Why bother with a startup?
I think it's just the hunger to create direct impact. We had been solving problems at the research level where they could have indirect impact, where, oh, you now made, for example, for my thesis, I made robots curious. And then someone would use the curiosity of robots, for example, to take inventory in warehouses and solve problems. But in this case, we wanted to make a direct impact on the world and a direct impact to people and meet the people whose problems we are addressing. So startups seemed like the best way to do it. And I think the idea itself of digitizing the physical space, which means anything that people are putting themselves in danger, all the processes are too slow, where people have to go out with sensors to take samples of the environment. If we can make it as easily searchable as searching Google is and searching the web through Google is, it seemed like it will change the way we operate. And that will happen with or without the three of us. But what better way to make an impact to participate in this future? And I just want to give you a few examples, Kathleen, what this means for our customers today. And this is where I get all my motivation and joy to keep going forward. Because one of our customers just only last month called us saying, it's been an year with you, Sunkalp, and we have saved more than $1 million worth of inventory. Oh, you know what? You find us empty spaces directly in our warehouse. That means we don't have forklift drivers moving around and finding empty spaces. That saves us 5 to 7 shifts worth of work every day. And a 3PL customer just happened to say that, and this was really all the motivation I needed for the next year, is that we have doubled our footprint because they have upsold the visibility we provide them through the network to their customers. And that sort of visibility has helped them upsell their services and they've doubled their revenue. So it's just those efficiencies and revenue increments that we are bringing just by this core thesis of bringing the physical world to digital world at a press of a button.
You made an interesting point. You know, there's such a challenge to turn research, which is inside the academy, let's just say, into a product. And that's really what you did. But it took you a lot of thinking to get to what type of product your research could apply to, right?
Yes. So we were all academics, and I'm still, I think of myself an entrepreneur in training right now. So to us, our technology was the end all and be all, right? But when the motivational driver of, oh, we have to make an impact comes in, and suddenly what we were told to do specifically with resources at CMU was, if you want to make a business, if you want to make an impact, understand the problems out there. And the only way to understand the problems was to meet with potential customers, people whose problem we want to solve. And that was the customer discovery journey we went through. And before we started the company, it was about 175 customer discovery interviews. That sounds like very little for a startup because, you know, we are still doing it. But when you're also finishing your PhD and doing this in parallel, it was quite a task, but it also led us to a robust business model.
Well, you ended up getting connected with Emirates, the Dubai-based airline. They got interested in your technology. Tell us about how you proved your technology out to them.
Oh, yes. So this was, as I was thinking about creating a business, there are also B-school courses that I was taking while doing my PhD. And
B-school being business school, right?
Business school, yes, yeah. at CMU. Because CMU doesn't restrict you what kind of course you want to take. So it wasn't in my credits or specifically related to my curriculum, but I could take the course. So this was a class by Professor Stuart Evans and funded by Emirates actually for projects. So as we were going about discovering their problems, they said one of their biggest problem is finding out what's on the floor in their warehouse. And I said, I think I can solve that problem because it just needs curious drones to solve that problem. And warehouses are vertical in nature. And we got to discover why that is a problem, because mostly warehouses are fast-paced environments. People make mistakes. And if your warehouse is relatively full, those mistakes have a chain effect on, oh, I placed one pallet wrong, which means I'll also place the next pallet wrong. So it becomes a bigger problem. It took, after inception of the idea and going through this, yes, we can solve that problem for you, it took us together an year for Emirates to come back to us that we are ready to fly you to Dubai. Can you show us that you can solve this problem for us? So while I was still finishing, I was in the final months of writing my thesis, so was Daniel, and Gitesh was a research staff at CMU. He's like, oh, maybe we can solve this problem. We told them, give us 2 days. We will do a demo for you in 2 days. So they flew us out there and gave us 2 days to have a prototype ready for how we can help them out. And to our amazement and their amazement together, what used to take them 4 people hours, our drones did it in under 8 minutes, which is a prototype product that we developed over the course of essentially these 2 days.
Talk about going above and beyond. You fly to Dubai for 2 days and fly your drones around the warehouse, right? So you ended up then, you started pitching to all these venture capitalists, and you had very different experiences pitching to the Midwest venture capitalists versus the West Coast venture capitalists. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it was fascinating. We actually learned by pitching to VCs in Pittsburgh. And I think given there is a lot of tech in Midwest, a lot of tech in Pittsburgh itself at CMU, somehow those VCs are jaded by, oh, there is this tech, but will it commercialize? So we got a lot of rejections. I don't know if I shared this with you, Kathleen, but around 75 no's before our first term sheet. But our first term sheet was from a Midwest VC, but it was a fairly low valuation. And as soon as we started pitching to investors in Bay Area, the valuations immediately went up. Our first term sheet was in front of us in a month's time. And then the Midwest VCs actually were able to match those terms that the West Coast VCs came up with.
Ain't that America? You did an unusual demonstration in the office of one of the West Coast or San Francisco-based venture capitalists. I think it involved masking tape.
Yes. So just a bit of background. This was Expa VC who led our pre-seed round. And they visited us at Swartz Center at CMU. And we showed them the tech. And we said that we are going to take this commercially off-the-shelf drone and just make it autonomous indoors. And that had not been done before. And a lot of companies had tried and failed. So even though they liked us, they liked the team, they saw our pedigree with what we have done before. But they said, okay, come to our office, pitch to our partners, and show the tech in action. We already had practice for the two-day demo. Now it had to be just put into a four-hour demo, essentially.
In a conference room, right?
In a conference room. So we were in the conference room, did our pitch. They said, okay, then show it to us in action. Said, okay, there's no warehouse here, but we can take a wall of the conference room, convert it into a warehouse layout using masking tape, and show that the drone, our autonomy engine can fly the drone autonomously without any GPS, just using cameras. We didn't have money to pay for hotels back then. So we flew in that morning and left San Francisco that night, not knowing that that meeting led to a $2.5 million pre-seed round.
Apparently, there's a lot of flying around involved for you as well as the drones, right?
That's true.
You've done no outbound marketing, and your website wasn't search engine optimized until very recently. How have you gotten customers?
This was such a pleasant surprise. And I think as a result of our customer discovery, we were convinced that we are going after a strong problem. But when we launched our website, August 2019, within the first month, we were overwhelmed by demand. And that was the first month. We didn't do any SEO. And that just validated our thesis that there is a strong, urgent demand for the problem we are solving. And there were companies before us that had tried to solve that problem, spent a lot on marketing. So we didn't have to build awareness. We just had to make a solution that actually works. That goes on even today. There is a lot of competition in the market where our competitors actually spend a lot on marketing. But even though customers have piloted with our competitors, they end up going with us because we have just focused on tech thus far and just making the solution.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a moment with Sankalp Arora, co-founder and CEO at Pittsburgh-based Gather AI. Keep listening to Midwest Moxie on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Welcome back to Midwest Moxie. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, and I'm joined by Sankalp Arora, whose startup, Gather AI, offers a software-based autonomous inventory management platform for warehouses. A note to our listeners, the next part of this conversation touches on the topics of depression, anxiety, and one individual's experience with suicidal thoughts. Sankalp, you grew up in a middle-class family in New Delhi. How did you get to Carnegie Mellon?
So the short answer is I got really fortunate because growing up in Delhi in a middle-class family, education at CMU is quite expensive. So I could have never dreamt of being educated at such a prestigious institute. But fortunately enough, my work that I did during my undergrad, professor at CMU, Sanjeev Singh, and global program manager, Rachel Bursin, I put in an application and they accepted. And Sanjeev offered me essentially a verbal deal saying, you come work for me for 3 months for free. And if I like you, I'll offer you a staff position. And to me, that was just like the golden ticket, right? Because I would get to learn from the best of the best. And people whose books I'd been reading in Delhi would actually be there in offices around me. So I was like, yes, I'll do that. Although I couldn't quite afford the tickets out to US and all that. So my dad bought the tickets and gave me $1,500 for those 3 months. And it's like, okay, if it pans out, that's great. Otherwise, I'll come back. And I had a job offer lined up.
We should say you had been at a prestigious undergraduate college in India, and yes. And you had been interested in robots since a very young age, right?
Yeah. My cousins tell me that I used to say that I want to make robots when I was 5-6 years old. But I was at a very prestigious school in India, Delhi College of Engineering. And in India, fortunately, government subsidizes prestigious schools. So I didn't have to worry about tuition there too much.
And when you say that was your ticket, Carnegie Mellon is one of the best centers in the world for robotics.
Yeah. And they suffer from that Midwest, U.S. Midwest thing of not publicizing yourself. Because when I announced it to my dad, that dad, I got an internship at CMU. He asked me, are you sure this is not a fraud? And then he looked up. He didn't even look up. He asked a friend whose kid was studying in U.S. And he said, this is the best school for robotics in the world. You should be happy about this.
Wow. And just to carry through with that theme, when you were still a graduate student, you worked on the world's first safe autonomous helicopter. It won the Howard Hughes Award and other prestigious prizes. What was it like when you realized it could really fly by itself?
It was magical. For a kid growing up in Delhi, always dreaming of making robots, to be standing in FBI training grounds in Quantico, 5-star army generals behind me, and this helicopter coming in and lands with a bunch of snow plume that it blows up while avoiding obstacles like hay bales that we placed, and lands itself. Just, I have it recorded as a video in my head. And it was actually at that time that it had just covered 10 kilometers of area in under 3 minutes, built a beautiful 3D model of the world it had covered. That this idea of that drones are exceptional data gathering machines and they need to have a broader impact in the world came up. But it's just a childhood dream come true.
Just to put that in context, a year or two earlier, before that autonomous helicopter landing, you had been an undergraduate student in India and you were trying to make autonomous pieces of equipment, right?
Yeah, I was trying to make an autonomous ground vehicle with a team in my college. And we were trying to get our hands on a laser to 3D map the terrain. And it took us 3 years to get those permits. By the time we got the laser, I had graduated. And in contrast, there was this full-scale helicopter here with a person sitting inside fully autonomous. And it had a laser in front of it that could look down up to 1.5 kilometers. And the laser itself costed $150,000.
And you've had many achievements along with that. I mean, your dissertation for your PhD, for example, was really groundbreaking in terms of making robots curious, right?
Yeah, and I think it was all driven from this intention of that if drones are such amazing data gathering machines, they have to reason about their own capacity to gather data. And I think that is genuinely what being curious is, to understand what data can I gather or can I gain, and then going out and doing actions for the same.
That was your insight, right? That whole data gathering way of thinking about it. Right?
Yes, yeah. And we were able to put it from full-scale helicopters to tiny backpack carryable drones for again, Department of Defense-funded research, where they could say, oh, find me all the moving assets in an environment from their location. And this would cover the area of roughly 30 football fields in under 7 minutes and give you number plates of the cars that are moving.
You're being modest. You were a key person in the development of those backpack drones, right?
Oh yes. I developed the main algorithm that made it so that it could be such an effective data gatherer, the motion planning algorithm.
Despite successes and achievements, there can be a dark side to being in such a globally competitive environment. Tell us about your own struggles with mental health.
So this is quite personal, and I'm glad you ask, because it's often not talked about. So with being at a highly competitive place where you're surrounded by people who excel, there is a pressure to excel, of course, but in a PhD setting, you're supposed to make contributions that are just attributable to you. And you're supposed to make contributions that push the state of the art. It's beyond what people know already. So that pressure to succeed and excel and combined with the loneliness of that you have to do this and having no social fallback because you're supposed to be consumed by your research. Just led me down this path of anxiety and depression, and suicidal tendencies became just a thing of daily routine that I would wake up and sleep with those thoughts and trying to do actions on those thoughts. I'm just really fortunate that the psychological counseling for students at CMU helped me a lot. For 6 months, I was under therapy there, and it gave me frameworks to identify patterns of depression and anxiety and how to deal with them. And at the same time, there was support from my PhD advisor, Sebastian, and family as well, where I was surprised. My dad told me that if you have to leave the PhD program and come back, it's okay. And I could never imagine him saying that, given it was such a big opportunity for someone like me.
Well, I would imagine being in a new country without the social network and family network you had in India also played in.
Oh, yes, massively, because then you're lonely with your negative thoughts all the time. Mm-hmm. And then you don't want to share those thoughts with your family back home because they've essentially sent you here to succeed.
You think a lot of PhD students at competitive programs have similar experiences as well, right?
Yeah, that was true with my peers at grad school, at CMU in robotics, or peers at MIT and Stanford. It was all pervasive. Mental health struggles, because the conditions are perfect for it almost, with the drive to do something excellent and make an impact on the world. Couple that with loneliness, and you're surrounded with excellence continuously. Up the hall, there is an office of Anthony Stenz, who made the motion planner for the robot that's on Mars. So whatever progress you make, those are the things that you have to measure against. And so whatever progress you make seems trivial.
And then being an immigrant adds to it because you don't have normal people you're interacting with. Normal, I say, with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think being an immigrant plays a role, definitely, because there is a cultural shift. But generally, being a PhD student means that most of the time you're spending with your work.
Some people wouldn't want to talk about their mental health challenges, even if they're in a highly competitive environment. What makes you willing to talk about it?
I think the crux of it is that I went through this discovery of how I could come out of it through a lot of pain. And there is no reason, if I can share my experiences, maybe someone doesn't have to go through that painful discovery. Maybe they can find out that, oh, I just need to talk to a therapist and figure out a structure around this. And as loneliness plays a key role, and everyone thinks that they are lonely in feeling that they are a failure, because that's how I felt like when I was going through that. I just want people to know that they're not. It's just mind playing tricks. And these are some of the people who are working on the most important problems that matter to humanity. And if they can be at their 100%, we'll just be a better society overall.
Obviously, it's a process and there's a whole support structure you're talking about. But can you talk about maybe some of the things that were most important in coming out of that experience?
So I think getting support from the university in terms of access to therapy was really important. And because I, as at a grad student stipend, one can not really afford therapy other than if it's provided by university. Second was, and this just did make a massive difference, where people who you're surrounded by are excellent people. I'll take Red's example, Red Whittaker, who basically is the father of field robotics, cleaned up the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. Most of today's autonomous car leaders can be traced back to Red and Red's lab. And I expressed to him that, you know, I don't think my PhD thesis is worth it. I think I should quit, right? I was about to defend. And he shared that he has gone through similar struggles. Someone who has achieved so much in life, sharing that and being so vulnerable in reaffirming that this is just a part of it, and you have to get tools and equip yourself to on how to solve it through getting help. It was such a wake-up call and such a relief that I'm not alone in this. And I think that's the most important part, just knowing that you're not alone in it.
What was Red's reaction when you told him you were worried your work wasn't good enough?
In typical Red fashion, he just said that it's okay to pursue excellence, but always good to see things as they are. And he said, your thesis is great and you should be proud of the work you've done. But at the same time, validated that he has felt like that in his life as well. And that is just a part of pursuit of excellence.
I think this all relates to you and your two co-founders. You're all immigrants. When mm-hmm. you were putting together the ideas for your startup and when you were trying to find the use cases, you really were driven to figure out those use cases. There were some immigration issues involved too, right?
Yes, because the USCIS, I forget the full form, but that's the authority that controls immigration laws, has a mandate on post their education, immigrants can stay only for X period of time, and that is roughly 3 years for someone who is in STEM fields. And you have to be paid at market rates for your qualifications to be allowed to stay in the country. So we didn't have the luxury to wait to figure out what the problem is that we want to solve after we get done with the school. We had to figure that out while we were in the school so that we could pay ourselves right out of the school.
So having been really through a lot of the ups and downs of a startup already, give us some tips that you've got for other entrepreneurs.
I think everyone's journey is personal. All I can say is make sure you have conviction on the problem that you're solving. And that conviction is validated by market data. Rest, everything else will follow because you're solving a problem that people care about and are willing to pay money for. The other thing that is very important, just to add to that conviction, maybe you have conviction towards a problem you're solving and you know people will pay for it now, but you also need to be passionate about it. Because if you're not passionate about solving that problem, just the startup grind will get you.
This wraps up season 2 of Midwest Moxie. You can read more about SunCulp and explore all of our episodes at wuwm.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. You've been hearing from visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.